Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. It's my pleasure to be with you. I know we have Kirk here this evening, and I did see an indication that JB was in the chat room, so I hope he is with us,
JB,
as well. But perhaps he'll join us a little later. We do have some interesting news that last week's show, which I talked briefly about a number of items in the news, and one of those items in the news is I recommended once again, and I've been consistent on this, that people avail themselves of the vaccines for COVID-19. I am double vaccinated. My wife is double vaccinated. All my friends are vaccinated. It was a non-event, and I have read the copious amount of literature from around the world, but particularly from Israel, which has done the best job of reporting on the upside and downside of the vaccine. And it, as it turns out, my experience overall, as I have researched anyway, as I've talked about vaccines throughout the past, is that vaccines on the whole are one of the greatest inventions in human history. We have done more to benefit life, the quality of life, and to prolong life with vaccines than probably anything else that man has ever invented. That does not make the vaccine perfect. You know, everything has a downside. You can drink too much water and die. You know, everything it's called drowning. But you don't get enough water, you're going to die. The most dangerous of the vaccines is probably the most widely prescribed, that mumps, rubella, and I don't know what the other one is, but it has about a 1 in 400,000 chance of a serious side effect. And for those that have the unlucky event of having the 1 in 400,000 negative event, that it's a tragic thing. But for the other 399,000, 999, the vaccine is exceedingly positive, and it affects not only the person's life who is being vaccinated, but many other people who are no longer exposed to the disease. So when we had our first encounter with the conspiracy nutcases, what I did is I went through all of the most prevalent conspiracies and systematically showed that evidence and reason proves that they are all absolute rubbish. Vaccines actually came into the forefront of conspiracy because of a doctor in the UK, I believe. He has now moved to the United States. And he was claiming that children with various hyperactive disorders and the like were given their disorder through the vaccine, in this MMR vaccine. And it turns out he was actually a hack paid to work on behalf of a company that made a competitive vaccine and made the whole thing up, that his research was completely bogus. There was no validity to it. He was exposed by the European and particularly UK medical journals. He was tried. He was convicted. He was stripped of his medical license, and so he came like a phoenix and was renewed in Texas, the land of conspiracy nutcases. And sorry, JB, if you're listening, but there is a high percentage of...
There's plenty of them. I had one the other day bringing me down.
Yeah, of nutcases. And this is how that anti-vaccine conspiracy started to blossom. Now, it has gone from being based on just somebody being stupid and not bothering to study the case of how conspiracy against vaccines started. When we did a number of shows on it, so I don't need to repeat that at this point. But today, it's gone to the point of just sheer craziness. I mean, absolute lunacy. The anti-vaxxers would have you believe that there is a tracking device that was either designed by the U.S. government or by Bill Gates, depending on who they want to blame, that is the actual reason that these vaccines are given. And I'm here to tell you that that's the most stupid idea I've ever heard of. First of all, there is one common denominator among conspiracy advocates. They have miserable, useless lives. They got nothing going for themselves, and so they want to blame others for their horrible existence. That's not my opinion. That's the research. And so I'm here to tell you, Bill Gates has got better things to do with his time than follow you around. The U.S. government doesn't give a crap about what you're doing with your life. You're a loser. Nobody wants to know what you're doing.
Sorry.
If they should, if the world got so bored that the most boring losers in the world became interesting, then they would go about tracking you via your cell phone, which they do. Anybody that is of interest to them, but let's be very clear. You're not of interest to them.
Well, I'm one of those people who argue that are the same people that post every status update on Facebook, Twitter, and everything else, telling the whole world what they're doing at every given moment.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, and of course, are chatting amongst themselves, because all you've got for conspiracy is circular reasoning. It's a bunch of people who are trapped in this religion of conspiracy, reinforcing one another with absolutely hysterical claims. The second is that they want to cast Bill Gates. I don't know what they've got against Bill Gates. I mean, I was never a fan of Microsoft. I didn't like their business tactics. I didn't like their history. I'm not a fan of Microsoft. I don't like how they built a monopoly and took advantage and took down so many companies in the process. So I'm not a fan of Bill Gates. I'm not a fan of Microsoft. And yet, to suggest that Bill Gates is using his billions of dollars because he wants to rid the world of people, and that he wants to track people, or some other lunatic idea, is just absurd.
Mm-hmm.
It is complete lunacy. And Bill Gates has not developed the technology to track your miserable life. If Bill Gates, after building Microsoft, if his next endeavor was to use the vaccine to depopulate the planet, then he's doing a really crappy job, because the death rate as a result of this vaccine is about nil, and the death rate for those who don't take it is substantial. So this time, he would have really screwed up. But let's not bother to think about facts. I had a number of the conspiracy buffs write me this week, and one said that Yahweh provided their freedom not to subject themselves to government policies. Yeah. And that was the reason that they said I could not object to them refusing to get the vaccine. I don't care if somebody refuses to get the vaccine.
They have free will.
You are free to be stupid. You know, wear your sign, I am stupid, I'm not vaccinated because I think Bill Gates is trying to control the world. Wear your sign.
Take your mark.
All I've said is, well, you have the right to kill yourself if that's what you wish to do.
Don't,
and this person
don't
said,
kill me.
I've got this God-given immune system. It works just beautifully. Well, if the God-given immune system is working so well, then there would be no reason to do anything to improve your health. Every time that something happens, you say, oh, my God-given immune system, I'm going to do squat. Why bother to eat? Why bother to do anything? You know, why bother to fix a broken leg? Your bones will heal. They might heal at a 90-degree angle, but they'll heal. You know?
Yeah, you're telling me if we had polio.
Yahweh gave you the right to be stupid. You can be religious. You can be conspiratorial. You can be political. You can go and kill yourself if you want to. You can be an alcoholic. You have the right to do all of those things. Doesn't make. But the thing that bothers me is when these nincompoops put out this kind of nonsense and use Yahweh's name. You wouldn't even know Yahweh's name if I hadn't introduced you to it. And the thing that
That's
bothers
true.
Me is when these nincompoops want to congregate around Steve Smyrna's, BB's, YouTube account where he posts these shows, for example, or my buddy David, down under in the land of Oz, when he wishes to do it, they congregate around their sites to spew conspiracy propaganda, particularly now the anti-vaxxers. That is the conspiracy du jour.
Well,
you want to go publish your rubbish? Go do it among yourselves. Go do it with somebody that agrees with you. Don't do it at a place that has begged you to go away. I don't want anything to do with you. I am never going to agree with you. Yahweh doesn't want anything to do with you. Go away. Now, if you don't get the picture, and if you can't handle being rejected again and being told just to go away, then we're going to begin this show reading where we began a program 2 weeks ago at the beginning of Passover, which I didn't write these words. Yahweh inspired them. And I want you to deal with what he had to say. Because, well, I am not bothered that one of the nincompoops listening to this show, whether it was Yahweh Soldier or Jamie, who's deep into it, or any of the other people that are try to have one foot in both camps. They want to pretend like they're covenant while spouting this conspiracy nonsense. That one of them, or multiples of them, wrote Google, YouTube, and lied and claimed that the last program was violated the protocol on vaccines, which means they would have said that I was promoting anti-vax when I am in fact vaccinated and have always encouraged people to be vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, by the way, it's just like this person that said, you know, Yahweh gives me the right not to to have to do this thing. You know, if you read the Torah, what did Yahweh say if there's an infectious disease that affects a community? Send
separate,
the infected people out. Put masks on and send that other person out and quarantine them. And don't let them back in until they're asymptomatic for 2 weeks. And everything they wear and everything that touches them, wash with lye. Yahweh didn't say, as a infected person, you can go and infect other people. That's selfish. It's deadly.
Horrible.
But nonetheless, we had a couple of nincompoops that listened to this program that wrote these companies. I think even Facebook had a conniption fit as well. And we have entered a world of thought police. And the thought police exist at Google. They exist at Amazon. They exist at Facebook. Most people don't know, but Facebook is the dominant player in social media. The single largest social media platform is actually YouTube, which is owned by Google. And the thought police over these institutions are about as thoughtless as the conspiratorial nuts. They are exceedingly liberal, and they don't want anything said that doesn't fit in with their view of the world. So we have moved to a situation that you would have found in communist Russia, where anything that was said that was opposed to, contrary to the mantra of the party, well, same thing is true in China today. Anything that you say that is contrary to the party is banned. They restrict access to Internet sites. And so what we're finding in the United States is these corporations are now acting as the Communist Party does in China. And evidence and reason don't matter. You can't explain that, I'm sorry for you, but you just banned a show that did the opposite of what you're claiming. Therefore, please apologize and post the show. But when you approach them, they deny any request to be reasonable. Now, I really don't care. Well, I do care that these conspiratorial nutcases continue to send me and others emails, and they continue to promote their religion using Yahweh's name and covenant references as if they were covenant. I care about that light a lot because this conspiracy is this giant cesspool of credibility. It's the black hole of credibility. Sucks it all in. So I don't like that around Yahweh's testimony, which is why Yah said, don't do it. But so that bothers me because it's a direct affront to Yahweh's credibility, and his credibility is essential. But when somebody like YouTube pulls a bonehead move based upon one of the nut jobs that want to be in both camps lying to them, that doesn't bother me. And you might say, well, why wouldn't that bother him? Aren't you committed to sharing this message that Yahweh has revealed through his Torah prophets and Psalms? Yes, I am. But I made a deal with the Almighty, and I'm really glad that the deal that I made is the one that we have in force, which is that we are not responsible for the communication and the promotion of this message. Yahweh is. Therefore, if someone like Steve, someone like Goad, someone like Dee, someone like you, JB, that posted on your site, someone like David, so many others that are doing that, you feel that it's the appropriate thing, come to conclusion, the appropriate thing to do, you do so. And that's wonderful. Trying to fight for access to people is just not in our responsibility. It's God's. The person who was censured is God's trying to get his message out to his people to call them home. And if you want to block that, then deal with God.
Yeah.
So after a couple of other items in the news, why don't we just clean up some of the news items. Israel has said that it's not going to cooperate with the International Criminal Court war crimes investigation. Can you imagine you want to go after Israel when their first crime, according to the International Criminal Court, is Israel is building homes without authority. Now, of course, those that there will be defending are killing without authority. They're terrorists.
Yes.
But the world is so ever-loving mad
warped
that they're going after Israel in the war between Israel and the Palestinians. Now, mind you, there's no such thing as a Palestinian. Mind you, there's no such place as Palestine. Those are facts. It's not my opinion. Look it up. You don't like that, then it's sad that you can't deal with the truth. But those are facts. And in this case, Islam has caused the Muslims to be terrorists. They attack Israel. They send rockets. Israel responds. Don't send rockets. Israel doesn't respond. They dig tunnels to commit suicide bombings. Israel responds. Don't dig the tunnels to commit suicide bombings. Israel's not going to respond. It's pretty simple. Israel has a right to defend herself.
Yes.
And to blame the country that is successfully defending itself as opposed to the country that is antagonizing and terrorizing them is idiotic. What it says is that you're prejudiced, that you're thoughtless, that you're irrational, that you're immoral. Damn right, there are homes in Gaza that have been destroyed because the Muslims have sent rockets out of those homes. And yes, you can get an ugly-faced Palestinian woman wearing a hijab to cry, "Oh my God, they buried my home!" Don't allow them to launch rockets from your home, and it won't occur. The Prime Minister of Pakistan, land of the pure Muslims, Imran Khan, is on the hot seat in the world, not in the world of Islam, because he told women in a human rights group in Pakistan that women are responsible for being raped. He said that the rise in sexual assault is because women are not dressing in tents all the time. We can see more than your eyes, and we can't help ourselves, he said. Men can't control themselves, and so women that show more than their eyes are responsible for luring men into acts of rape. How do you like that, apples? And yet, do you know of any liberal organization or any women's rights group that is out protesting Islam?
Zero.
For advancing those views?
Zero.
No. We now have protesters and corporations having tizzy fits over the new voting rights law in Georgia. And the key to the voting rights law in Georgia is that at the very least you have to have a photo ID to vote. Now, the problem with the last election is that you didn't have to prove who you were to vote. You could mail in multiple ballots. You could drive through and vote multiple times. You didn't have to prove your identity. And so the liberals, who like that because they have no ethics and love the idea of winning an election by fabricating votes and then not being held accountable, they don't want anyone to wreck their new gig. And so what they're saying is that it is grossly unfair to blacks and minorities to require them to show an ID to be able to prove that they are, in fact, registered to vote. And that same-day registration is a very bad idea because there's no way for validation checks to see if the person really is who they claim to be. That's what they're doing. So what the liberals are saying is that this is unfair to blacks. Why? Because they're not capable of getting a photo ID. You know, if you're not capable of getting a driver's license or a photo ID, what contribution are you going to make to the voting process? What do you know about economics? What do you know about foreign policy? I mean, how is it that somebody who's not smart enough to get a driver's license or a photo ID or to register more than like a week prior to the election is going to know enough about any of the issues to make an intelligent decision? And yet you have corporations, not corporations so much as overpaid liberal executives, condemning Georgia and moving things out of Georgia because they want a free-for-all. Exceedingly sad. Now let's turn to Iowa's testimony. After describing the importance of the Ark of the Covenant, which had been placed in the center of Yah's home, Solomon reiterated many of the wonderful things which would benefit Israel if the people continued to love Yahweh, to sing his father's songs, to observe the Torah's guidance as well, but knowing they would not, realizing that their descendants would require another exodus of their own. Solomon conveyed the following. This is the first, the original, perhaps the only Sermon on the Mount. It was given at the completion and thus dedication of Yahweh's home on Mount Moriah. Therefore, he began, Wagam, what's more? Regarding someone else, an observant and discerning foreigner from a different ethnicity and a different geographic location, who will come to understand Ha Nakri, the Nakri, someone of a, from a different place and culture, speaking a different language, who having paid attention will comprehend from Nakar, being attentive and astute, to become acquainted, to recognize, to acknowledge something which deserves our highest regard and respect. Who to show the way to the benefits of the relationship? Wagam Nakri Asher is not of your people, this Yisrael. Now, that's just by itself is stunning, really.
Mm-hmm.
Can you name any other place where Yahweh says, all right, forget about the fact for a moment that this is the dedication of Yahweh's home, the temple on Mount Moriah, mm-hmm. and that this is the last fleeting years of Yisrael being united as a people. And with his entire message being conveyed through Yisrael and being conveyed to Yisrael. Yahweh
yep.
says, I want you to understand that there's going to be a Nakri who is going to be observant, who's going to speak a different language and come from a different place, who to show the way to the benefits of the relationship is not of your people. He's not an Israelite. There is no other place where this occurs.
You know.
He will come from a distant country in a distant time. Men Eretz Rokok, out of a land far from Yisrael and following a long interval of time, for the express purpose of being a reliable witness and providing truthful answers, Lama'an, for the sake of responding and replying, providing testimony as a witness, with the express intent and purpose of revealing your surprisingly important name, HaGadol Shem, tremendously empowering and distinguished, growth promoting and magnifying, astonishingly great name. Pause there for a moment. All of mm-hmm. these idiots that I have tried to excoriate and send on their merry way, our miserable way, that promote conspiracies, and now their new one is anti-vax hysteria, are all speaking out in Yahweh's name. That's reprehensible. They wouldn't know Yahweh's name if it wasn't for what we have done through these shows.
What you said. Yeah.
Absolutely. The only reason they know it. There's no other place where Yahweh's name is conveyed as Yahweh correctly. No other place where it's being emphasized like this. I mean, the whole series that we're writing, and now we have 2 feet of books just looking at the spine, is Yada to know Yahweh. Even questioning Paul now has been rebranded Yada Yahweh. Observation series, Yada Yahweh. Observations by Yada Yahweh. Coming home by Yada Yahweh. It is something that is unique to what we're doing here. It should be unique, but it is. The influence of your hand. Well, there's 2 aspects of that. One is we uniquely care about the Paleo-Hebrew, where Yahweh's name is written with a hand reaching down and out to us, the first letter in his name. It is also unique in that we recognize that Yahweh has announced who his right hand is. The right hand of Yahweh is Dod. And we have uniquely come to recognize that. The influence of your hand, along with the powerful and passionate ruler who is prepared to lead, HaShazak. Prepared to lead. What did Yahweh say about Dod? He gets up early in the morning and is prepared. Who was the only accomplished leader of Yisrael that Yahweh chose? Dod. Who was responsible for unifying Yisrael and bringing them home to Jerusalem?
Dod.
He is the powerful and passionate ruler who is prepared to lead, which is exceedingly important because guess who's coming back to dinner? No, it's funny. We know that Eliyahu is coming back for Passover. But Dod is coming back to rule the world.
Yeah.
And so it's important that we know that he is the passionate ruler who is prepared to lead, strong and influential, a fighting spirit who is ready and able to protect his people from those who would otherwise seek to harm them. And the protective ram who shepherds the flock, Zeruah. There are 3 Zeruah.
Yep.
Moshe was a Zeruah, according to Yahweh. Dod is the Zeruah, according to Yahweh. Yosha was also a Zeruah. The Zeruah is a protective ram. The Zeruah is a productive shepherd. The Zeruah is the sacrificial lamb. Moshe, Dod, and Yosha collectively fulfill those roles. This person, he says, that he's speaking of, is a Zeruah. I don't think there's any other place in the history of commentary and translation of Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms, who has come to recognize that any one of these 3 men was the Zeruah, much less all 3. And it's really interesting that in Yeshayah 53, which is the one passage in the prophet of Yeshayah that was 2 that Christians like to speak of because they think it speaks of their Jesus. It actually does speak of Yosha, but as the Passover lamb.
Mm-hmm.
The passage begins with 2 very interesting propositions. The first proposition is, it says that that to unlock the understanding of this passage, to appreciate its timing and influence, the first thing you need to know is, who are Yahweh's Zeruah? And I remember I was I was in the process of trying to properly translate the full scope of what Zoroa means, which is what brought us to this Nakri presentation we're reading now, but it's also brought us to Yeshaya 53, where Yah was saying that that single most important prophecy on Yosha as the Passover lamb. It's only understood when you understand the identity of the three Zoroa. Something, again, unique to this process, whom you have reached out and will extend. Ata ha nata. When he arrives, speaking now of the Nakri again, on the scene, and chooses to pursue this, when he comes bringing and bearing these associations, wanting to clarify the proper direction towards the ultimate goal, which is to enter back into a relationship and be included in the family, then he will help interested parties reconcile their relationship by providing those who exercise good judgment with the information and justifications needed to make a correct and reasoned decision. Halal. It has been the primary purpose of these many books and shows to take what has been discarded by faith, what has been maligned by opinion, which many claim is unknowable, and to lay it out is in the form of evidence and reason. That is what we have sought to do. If you're interested, we're going to provide the evidence and help you think your way through it so that you can make an informed and rational decision about God and your relationship with Him. What you choose to do is up to you. This Palal speaks specifically of our mission. And the decision is regarding the familial relationship, El Ha Beyeth Hazeh. When you hear this coming out of the heavens, coming from the atmosphere, Wa Ata Shama, Min Ha Shamaim, when you listen to what comes out of the spiritual realm by way of the sky, perhaps prophetic of radio waves, and especially satellite-based broadband internet connections now archived in the cloud, or yada yawa, you may not want to do what the conspiratorial nutcases did and lie about what we said to our last week and convince the thought police to remove this presentation of Yahweh's testimony. Probably ought not do that.
Probably a really
bad idea to do so. But, you know, your free will and all, you know, it's what that one guy that wrote me says, you know, Yahweh gave me the freedom to be a nincompoop if I wanted to. Well, how about it? See how well that works out for you. See if that makes your life better. See if that convinces more people to join you. So when you hear this coming out of the heavens, from the atmosphere, within the location where you live, then engage and act accordingly. Doing everything. Asha, ka, pol. Under the auspices of free will, endeavor to expend the considerable effort required to receive all of the benefits. Doing everything consistent with the example and pattern he has set, which, to show the way, the observant foreigner from a different ethnicity and geographic location who understands the Nakri has invited you to read. One of the things that is different about the approach that we have taken, and fortunately we've taken this approach because had we not taken it, we would have been disqualified from this prophecy. And if we're disqualified from this prophecy, there's no fulfillment of this prophecy, which means that Yahweh would have missed his first prophecy. He doesn't have a habit of doing that. We took a different approach. Today the approach is, and this is what feeds conspiracy, is video presentations. They got their little video chat. Oh, you need to listen to this video or watch this video from some fellow nincompoop telling other fellow nincompoops that they ought to be nincompoops. That's what they all do. Now, one of the things that I learned very on, and Yahwa taught me this, is that if you want to be credible, if you want what you have to say to be verifiable, if you want people to be able to look up what you are saying and validate it for themselves, write it down. Write it down and explain the basis of your translations, explain the basis of your conclusions. But write it down, because we have this really wonderful invention that is now managed by some thoughtless people called Google. I say thoughtless people because they made the idiotic decision at YouTube, actually thwarting what they allegedly are trying to advance. And you can copy and paste from the written word any one of these words in the translation and validate. You know, when I see a news story that says, oh, boy, that is really interesting, but I don't know if it's credible, I'll copy and paste certain aspects of the story into a Google search engine to see if I can find validation for it. It's the written word is eminently more credible because it endures unchanged, it can be processed much faster, and it's much easier to validate. So we've taken the approach of putting it in writing. You know, I'm looking right now at the books that Jackie has helped us publish and the Proof Squad has fact-checked and edited, and that we are rewriting of the material we've gone through thus far. And just at the spines, it's 2 feet wide. That's a lot of material based on the translations that translating Yahweh's word and sharing it in writing. I mean, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages, all offered at the cost of printing without any royalty and offered freely online. The Nakri is responsible for a nesh, which is a sign. Signs are printed. It's the written word, which can be kara, read. That's what this is saying, is here you ought to engage and act accordingly, doing everything which to show the way the observant foreigner from a different ethnicity and geographic location who understands has invited you to read. Kara.
When we all started.
Yeah, and I don't think you can look long and hard. And there are some people who have written, but no one on this material. And there's lots of people that have videos, but they've never written. God's not just telling you to act upon and engage in everything he has invited you to read. Why? Because he's not sharing his opinion. This is about Yahweh. It's his story in his words for the express purpose of being a witness who provides answers for advancing, not for advancing his own agenda. He doesn't have an agenda. Not for getting rich, because he loses money at this. Not for having a following, because he hasn't got one. Not for gaining power. He's moved halfway around the world to live in the middle of the ocean just so that be totally isolated. So the only motivation is to be a witness who provides answers, such that every person on earth will have a genuine and ongoing opportunity to become familiar with, to know, to acknowledge, to accept, to understand, yada, to being shown by yada, so they might appreciate and comprehend your name. Coming to revere you. Wala Yare Eth Ata. Once revitalized, will approach your Ida awesome nature. Simultaneously, along with your people, Yisrael. There are a number of places where Yahweh speaks of invited guests and Yisrael, those who have longed to be adopted into the family of Yisrael, benefiting from Pesach and the covenant. There is no other place where Yahweh begins to say that this person is speaking to the world simultaneously while inviting and speaking to Yisrael. Say,
note.
Both are important. God wants the world to know. And so that they may know and understand, Yada, that truthfully, he, assuredly, your family and this house, which to reveal the correct path to walk, to give meaning to life that I have built for the family, who are designated and called by your name. Powerful. What we've just read is from Dabarim Yayomen, Words of the Days. Second Chronicles, the last statement was 6:33. Now, with Solomon's speech still reverberating in our minds, it has become obvious that his Sermon on the Mount actually drew inspiration from Yahweh's presentation of the Shabbat of the Exodus, and that he referred and referenced Yah's presentation for a reason. The following four words appear one after the other in both statements in this order: Shazak, Yad, Zaroah, and Natah. It's not by accident. So, you should remember Zakar. Mention and proclaim that indeed you were a slave, a servant, in the land of the crucibles of oppression in Mitzrayim. I want to just take a moment to speak about Mitzrayim.
Mm-hmm.
If you are living in Mitzrayim today, you know what you call yourself?
American?
No.
You call yourself
Mitzrayim is still Mitzrayim. The people who live in Mitzrayim call themselves Mitzra and Mitzrayim.
Mitzra, yeah.
Yep, they use the same name. You know, the reason they use the same name is kind of funny. The Quran is a bastardized version of Hebrew. And so even the word Quran is from the Hebrew kara. And so with it being a bastardized version of Hebrew and with Muhammad being running out of plagiarized material from the Hanifs in Yemen, he started buying Talmud stories from Jewish rabbis and then twisting them to serve his agenda. And in one of those Talmud stories, the land of Mitzrayim was mentioned. And so he refers to the place as Mitzrayim, based upon the rabbinical account. So when the Muslims came into the land and pummeled the place, they accepted Arabic as their language and called themselves Mitzrayim. But nonetheless, that is what the name of the place is. Egypt is a Hellenized and Latinized rendering of based upon water and the Nile. It speaks of the water of the Nile. And by the way, the Egyptians didn't even refer to the river as the Nile, the Mitzrayim. And so every time the river was discussed or mentioned, you know what they called the river? This takes
No.
I'll give you one guess, and you ought to get this right. what did they call the river in a land that only had one river?
The river.
A river. That's what they called it. So in trying to create a name for the place, not caring about what Yahweh's name was, with Mitzrayim, they came up with a word for water. They pushed it into Egypt. That's how it came up.
It was sharp.
But Mitzra is an important concept. It's the plural of Mitra, which means delineated as a foe and besieged during a time of testing and tribulation. Mitzor is from Sur, T-S-U-W-R, which means to be bound and confined by an adversary, besieged, assaulted, shut up, and enclosed in what could be called a concentration camp by those showing great hostility. Sure is the word used at the time of Jacob's troubles. Troubles is sure. As well as metzar, which is to be aware of a state of troubling hardship during imposition of anguishing distress. Mitzra by itself, and the plural, is a crucible of oppression. It's a cauldron of religious and governmental persecution, military and economic subjugation. It's a place where people are coerced, where they're treated in a cruel manner. People are confined and restricted by religious and political institutions. There is a real message in Mitzrayim, all of which is squandered when it's changed to Egypt. There is no message whatsoever in Egypt other than the Hellenes and the Romans were arrogant in their and thoughtless in their names. Other than that, there's no value in it. But it's exceedingly important that we know from what Yahweh was saving his people, from what he was liberating and delivering his people. And when you understand what Mitzrayim means, then you understand from what God wants to liberate us. And it's from the crucibles of religious and political oppression, from military and economic subjugation, which we find throughout the history of civilizations. So it opens up a huge window of opportunity when we think of the words that it actually means. So it says, and so you should remember that indeed you were a slave in the land of the crucibles of oppression, and Yahweh, your God, brought you out. Yatsa descended and extended himself, came forth to lead and deliver you from there with a mighty and firm and powerful protective Shazak, very strong and influential, extraordinarily capable and intensely prepared hand, ability to accomplish the mission. And with the sacrificial lamb, the productive arm shepherding the flock, speaking of Moshe, Zeruah, and the first celebration of Pesach, the prevailing and effective nature, strength, resolve, and overall ability of this remarkably important and impactful individual of action, who as a leader and fighter is engaged as a shepherd among the sheep, who is fruitful in his ways, accomplishing the mission, especially when sowing the seeds of truth while denoting and advancing the purpose of the arm of God, of his shepherd and sacrificial lamb, all of which were extended. For this reason, Yahweh. Now, Yahweh is an accurate transliteration of the name of Eloah, God, as guided by his Torah instructions regarding his Haya existence and our Shalom reconciliation. Those words, none of which are controversial in any way, explain how to properly pronounce Yahweh's name. your God instructed you to approach by observing Lashamar, that which is associated with the time to celebrate the Shabbat, to observe the seventh day, the period of reflection at the end of the week, reminiscent of the promise of settling debts, so we can settle down and consider the oath of association, such that it is set apart and special. Dabarim, words, Deuteronomy 5:15, spoken by one of the three Zoroah. It is important to notice that while God has produced a considerable number of prophecies and gone on at length about his deployment of a Nakri and a Choder to accomplish the mission that he has to awaken his people and call them back home, to reconcile his relationship with Israel and indeed to proclaim his message to the world. The Nakri Choder is otherwise insignificant, meaningless. The three Zoroah are meaningful. They are God's primary implements, Moshe, Dod, and Yosha. And so it's important that we recognize that it is the characters in God's story that matter. All we are doing is correctly conveying his story and helping people understand it. Now, as we consider the implications of these statements, one from Solomon, two from Moshe, we're approaching the ultimate celebration of the Shabbat. Are we not? Surviving Israelites will soon be coming home to participate in Yom Kippur, the Day of Reconciliations, in the Yovel year of 6000 Yah, sunset, October 2nd, 2033. I shared this at the conclusion of a program 2 weeks ago, but what has transpired this prior week has made it such that I wanted to repeat what God had to say, because I don't think there's ever been a time when it's more appropriate to hear, to know, to recognize. And I did make a mistake as I shared this paragraph in that program, and I was advised to correct my mistake, which I appreciate, because I stated an errant year. But let me share this thought again, because it is just fascinating. I have been retranslating and rewriting the chapters on Pesach. This particular chapter we're sharing from now is the preamble chapter to the first volume on the Mikra. This is the prelude to the Exodus and prelude to Passover, the introduction of Passover. Because Passover has a historic message. This occurred in this place at this time to convey a lesson through history. It has a symbolic message of what Passover represents in our lives. It has a prophetic influence in what Passover will mean for us going forward, and how it would be fulfilled. In this case, Passover was fulfilled in year 4000 Yah by Yosha. All of those stories are embedded into the same account. And since we're talking about prophecy, there's very little, as everyone knows, of the Christian New Testament that I'll pay any attention to, but it appears that the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew was written by an Ebionite.
Loewy?
Probably Loewy, but an Ebionite. And that it was written in Hebrew and plagiarized by an imposter named Matthew, and perhaps the Olivet Discourse. And there are some portions of the book of Yohanan, probably portions of Shimon Kepesh's letters, maybe Jacob's letters, and the book of Revelation that that would be the sum total of what might be of some value.
And
as it relates, but that would be it. And as it relates to Revelation, there are some aspects of Revelation that are quite appealing because they do something I like to do, which is, all right, so Yahweh may talk about a certain event in Yirmiyah, he'll talk about it again in Yashayah, he'll talk about it maybe some more in Malachi and Ezekiel. And so the number of different windows that he provides on the same event. And what Revelation does is it takes some from Daniel and some from Zechariah and some from Malachi and a little from Yirmiyah, and it brings these pieces together such that, okay, not much of it is unique in the sense you can find it all in those other places, but it does bring it together in such a telling way, and occasionally it adds a tidbit here and there. So while the current rendition of Revelation is suspect, there are sections which emerge from the prophets, notably the Mizmor, Zechariah, Daniel, Yachetel, Yashayah, Yirmiyah, and Malachi, that can be reassuring and enlightening. Such an example may be the two witnesses of whom only Eliyah is named. If they remain active for what appears to be 1,260 days, followed by 3.5 days, as foretold, before ascending to heaven on Yom Kippurim, which would be in year 6,000 Yah, 2033, then 1,264 days earlier. It means that Eliyah would be arriving just in time to celebrate Pesach Passover on Wednesday, April 17th, 2030.
Cool.
And what's so cool about that is that rabbis on behalf of Jews have totally screwed up the Passover meal. Their Seder has everything but lamb. They throw a bone on the plate, which they call a zeroah, which you would break a tooth if you tried to eat, and giving you just this medley of religious vegetables to munch upon. It's like they went back to Cain and said, you know, we're not following Hebel. We're going to make an offering to God of vegetables. We're going to follow Cain's example. Worked out really well for him. But one of the things that the rabbis actually do is they set a place setting, and Jews follow this example all over the world. They set up a place where they have a glass of wine and fill up a plate for Eliyah, expecting Eliyah to return at Passover. Guess what? They got one right. They got one right. Eliyah is in fact going to return for Passover. Sukkah's Shabbat, which is the celebration of year 6,000 to 7,000 Yah, follows the time of Jacob's troubles, sure, when Israel will once again endure the sting of the crucibles of religious and political oppression. Therefore, for Yahweh to fulfill his promise to reconcile his relationship with his people, there will have to be another exodus, and this one away from the cauldrons of political, religious, and geographic Babylon. From the United States of America, where about 40% of the Jewish population lives, from the Roman Catholic Church, where there are many converso Jews, and now also the lands infected by Islam, where they're not having a good time with DNA testing because, well, when they run the DNA test, the people that they hate, they turn out to be those very people. There's a very high percentage of Jewish DNA amongst Muslims in the Arab world. And it's all because they enslaved them in Babylon, enslaved them in Assyria, and when your choice is later, convert or die, most people prefer to convert and die.
Yeah.
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 Tough choice. Sadly, as we now know, there was not a single willing Yahud through whom Yahweh could convey his message, which means that there would be no prophet or shepherd for his people at this time, as there was with Moshe, as there was with Dode. Now, that might seem sad, and it is sad that Yahweh couldn't find a single Yahud through whom to work. We actually don't need another prophet. I don't think there's enough. In fact, I know for certain there's not enough time left to properly translate and discuss the existing prophets. Oh, man, Yahweh left us with such a wealth of information. But there would nonetheless be a witness on Nakri who would write down and write about what those seeking to be with Yahweh would need to Kara read and Yada know. And he would translate Yahweh's testimony and that of Moshe and Dode, the words of the actual Hebrew prophets and shepherds, into English, the language spoken by more people today, including Jews, than any other. Time is growing short. You know, Yahweh's or Elia's return is, what, 9 years away? Just 9 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we're 12 years away from Dode's return. So time's growing short. There's a lot to translate, a lot to compile, a lot to write about, a lot of insights to share. And we ought to consider every possibility. If there's another candidate, I'd be the first to celebrate. And, you know, I might actually go scuba diving and play golf as opposed to sitting in this chair all day. I may not, because I actually like sitting in this chair all day, and I'm addicted to it now because I really love what we're learning. And every day is a new feast for the eyes. But if there were 1,000 doing it, that would even be better than 1 or 10 or 100. This is not a zero-sum game. You know, it's not like we are, you know, and I think this is the problem that Cain had. You know, he didn't like being excluded from the covenant, but what he didn't recognize is that he didn't need to kill his brother to somehow get a spot. You know, it's the experience in heaven and what we inherit in eternal life is actually made richer by more thoughtful souls than it is by fewer. Now, so the universe is so big and 7 dimensions so enormous, our share of it is not in any way diminished by having many more people engage. As a matter of fact, it'll be more interesting and richer very large. 7 dimensions is extraordinarily expansive, and each person brings the most interesting part of the whole experience, different viewpoints, you know, different insights to the experience. So Yahweh has made this prophetic pronouncement regarding the Nakri at the commencement and conclusion of the Exodus, and then he sought to appreciate why you know, it was included in Solomon and the Devarim. And what we didn't cover today, that we covered 2 weeks ago, is that as Moshe is explaining what's going to occur, this is now very early on in the process, as Yahweh is just now beginning to encourage Moshe to think about it. Moshe has fled Egypt. He is proving his mettle, his character in Arabia. And Yahweh is about to speak to him. It's the first use of Nakri in the Torah. And it is used in a way that invites us to consider how Solomon used it and how Moshe would use it as he developed a more complete understanding. All right, well, as is the case with every political despot and arrogant religious leader, even in the best of times, this is what Yahweh had to say. During those abundantly wonderful days, it was then that the king of Mithraim, the crucibles of oppression, died. And yet the children of Israel continued to groan from the work. They cried out in agony for help. They rose up, calling out for assistance unto the Mighty One because of their labor. Now that's a far cry from the Ibri, the Hebrew, that that shooed Moshe away for saying, you know, what right do you have to judge us? You know, who made you the big shot that can go off and not only kill an Egyptian, but then come back and tell us what's right and wrong? Well, this is now, we've had it. We can't endure it anymore. They rose up finally with one voice and called out to God and said, please, we need your help. It would take 400 years for Israel to reach the point that they would collectively plead for help. They had been enslaved three times longer than Africans in the American South. And their situation had been far worse. Perhaps equivalent to the Holocaust toward the end, with Jews being starved and tortured, worked to death and murdered, 400 years of Egyptian servitude would grossly exceed the torment of 14 years of slavery under the Germans. It was the longest and worst experience endured by anyone ever. So horrific, it would require God's intervention. You know, we have come to the point where when we talk about racism, when we talk about slaves, the attention is being focused wrongly against the United States. The United States, while there are races, and probably more racists among blacks than there are even Caucasians, but racism exists on no matter a person's religion or political persuasion or race, racism exists. Is it institutionalized and pervasive? No. I think the vast majority of people are not racist. In fact, I would go so far as to say, in the history of human civilization, the least racist nation with the greatest opportunity for an individual to prevail regardless of their race, their ethnicity, the conditions of their birth, is the United States of America. No nation has been anywhere close to it. If you go back in history, until really the end of probably the 1700s, the caste system existed around the world. The caste system existed really from the dawn of recorded history all the way up through the Renaissance and to some degree even beyond, where if you were a serf in Europe, you were part of a caste that you could never escape. The caste system still exists in India, which is but the second most populous nation.
Still there.
Yes. Yeah. The caste system was imposed in Rome. It was imposed in Greece. It was imposed in China. It was imposed in Japan. It was imposed in Carthage. It was imposed in the tribes in the Americas. The caste system existed everywhere. There was no upward mobility. And people of a different ethnicity were typically captured and enslaved. America is, as it relates to racial equality and opportunity, is the freest and most opportunistic nation in the history of the world. I'm not a patriot. I'm not a fan of America. But facts are facts. And so this revisionist thinking that America has this horrible, dark, racist soul is the opposite of what's true. And truth matters in all things. What's true is the people who have been victimized by racism the longest and the worst are Jews. There is no experience in human history worse than what the Mitzrah, now known as the Egyptians, did to Yahweh's people, Jews, Israelites, for 400 years. The worst example of racial discrimination and intolerance and slavery in human history. Worse than the Holocaust. And we need to put that in perspective when trying to think of our way out of things. And even today, because of conspiracy, the number one conspiracy in the world is blame the Jews. And so keep this in mind, that there was nothing more horrific than this. Now, these next four sentences convey Yahweh's nature and intent. Counter to the Christian myth, God can be relied upon to honor his promises. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Yishak, and with Jacob. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Yishak, and with Jacob. What God is saying here, if it wasn't for those promises, I wouldn't intervene. God had intervened once before during the flood with Noah, where he said that, you know, man had grown so violent, so political, so deadly and militaristic that he needed to intervene just to give us time and hope so that we didn't kill ourselves, obliterate ourselves. And he said, I won't do that again, at least not with a flood. God's reluctant to intervene, but he made a promise to Abraham. He said, you know, your people are going to go over here, and they are going to be enslaved, and after 400 years, I'm going to take them back out. He made a promise that to Abraham regarding his people, his descendants, and the covenant, and God is going to honor it, which means there can be no replacement for God. God acted because of the covenant. Period. It was his covenant, Mereth, that caused him to respond. He responds to his family. He responds to his children. He protects his children. It's the only place, really, where violence is warranted if you're protecting your children.
Mm-hmm.
And he did so on behalf of Abraham, Yishak, and Jacob. The descendants of Jacob are Israel. God saw the children of Israel, and the Almighty recognized, acknowledged, respected, and understood them. Yada. Mankind has behaved badly, really ever since the first communities. Raiding parties, cultures, religions, governments are all testament to this. In all of that time, Yahweh has only intervened twice to thwart the advance of nations and of institutions. The first was during the flood. The second is during the Exodus. There will be a third time. God will intervene again at the conclusion of the time of Jacob's troubles prior to his return. And that they represented the covenant, even with the inclusion of Noah's family. Each time God engaged, it has been and will be to protect his people. He did this for Israel because he made an unwavering commitment to Abraham. He reassured Yishak, and affirm the same thing with Jacob. So this statement is not only a harbinger of what is to come and that Yahweh will engage again to protect Israel. It is a broadside against Christianity. God has not made any such promises to Christians and is actually going to annihilate most for them, non-Israelites, rather than protect them upon his return. You can't have replacement theology and have Yahweh promising to honor his commitment to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. You can't have replacement theology and a New Testament based on a new covenant with Yahweh honoring his promises based on the existing covenant. As was the case with Dode, the temperament and experience of a shepherd is appealing to Yahweh. Both men were tending sheep when God first met them. Moshe was shepherding the flock. Of his father-in-law, Yitro, the Midian priest, the one who ministers to the contentious. He led, guided his sheep to the end of the desert wilderness, Midbar, the barren lace wasteland where the word is questioned. From me to ponder the implications of and to bar the word which is spoken. And he arrived at Horeb. I wonder why so few people actually take note of he was shepherding sheep at Horeb when God met with him and that God returned him to the same place to reveal the Torah. And he revealed himself as light on the top of this mountain just as he would once again when they returned. No, the coming back to the place you start is the theme of the Torah. That's the whole concept of Eden. The earth will be transformed and the conditions experienced in Eden. We're coming back to where we once were. Why God tells the story the way that he does. Just as mankind will soon return to the garden, Moshe would come back to this place, the mountain of the Almighty. The place where Yahweh introduced himself to Moshe, where God met with Israel, where he revealed his Torah. This dry and desolate place, with its summit piercing the sky, with its knife edge, a dividing line, separate, setting apart. It's located just 20 miles east of the eastern shore of the Gulf of Aqaba. And the spiritual messenger of Yahweh appeared to him. Why the spiritual messenger?
That's our spirit.
Yeah, Yahweh was seven-dimensional. He's not fitting into our three-dimensional world. Right. If Yahweh was there, you're going to see more than a flame. Poor Moshe would have been incinerated. Well, our earth would have been incinerated. It'd be like bringing 100 billion suns to the surface of the earth and seeing watch what happens. So Yahweh became visible via a spiritual messenger. The heavenly envoy, representative and ambassador of Yahweh, appeared, became visible, and was shown to him by means of a flaming fire, a labah, a spear of burning, the sharpened tip of a point, lab, a gleaming blade of a sword of fire. From the midst of men to walk. And this is where people get all caught up in the riches. Shina means of a rocky crack, a high and shimmering rocky cliff. Now, you'll read in your favorite Bible that he appeared to him as a flaming fire in the midst of a bush.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why would he mention Horeb? And why did he come back and say that Horeb, the whole top of the mountain, was ablaze? And yet at this occasion, just have a hot bush. Anyway, Shina, it's described elsewhere in the Torah. It's a rocky crack. You know, my name actually comes from this this concept as it's translated into Anglo-Saxon. Yep. Shina. And he looked up and beheld. Looked up. Ra'ah was observant and beheld. Kena means to look up and pay attention. Bushes are typically down. That the rocky summit, Ha-Sena, the high and sharp flag, was ablaze, kindled and illuminated with fire. But the Wa-Ha-Sena, but the crag, the high cliff and rocky place, was not consumed, was not eaten away or destroyed. Sana, which is a thorny bush or prickly shrub, and Sina, high rocky place and elevated and shimmering crag or cliff, are indistinguishable in the Hebrew text. However, like many who have searched maps of the land of Midian and who have examined pictures taken in the region, we've seen the burnt rocky heights of Mount Horeb. And this is the mountain of God, and Yahweh is the rock of our salvation. I would opt for a shimmering, high, rocky crag over a thorny bush.
Good choice.
Just me. Yeah, just me. Moreover, the spectacle was enormously massive, extensive, intense, and elevated, therefore rendering the crag a touch more reasonable than a really big shrub. I've got nothing against shrubs.
No. They burn up too fast.
I'm sure there's a thought police out there probably working for Google. Thou shalt not speak poorly of shrubs.
Of burning bushes, yes.
Yeah, burning bushes. Okay. The enormity and magnitude of this majestic spectacle of blazing light atop the jagged summit of Mount Horeb was so impressive, Moshe turned to take it all in. It was something so magnificent, he was eager to make sense of it all. When Yahweh saw that indeed he changed direction to draw near and see, God called out to him to meet with him from the midst of the rocky heights. Now, you read in your English Bible, you would have Sur La Ra'ah as Moshe turning away as if he's going to go and run and hide. No, it was just absolutely amazing. Listen, if the top of the mountain, I'm out there tending sheep, you're out there tending sheep, and the top, rocky top of a mountain is ablaze, are you going to hightail it out there? Or are you going to say, oh my goodness, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. What's going on here? He was in no danger. He's not going to run. He wanted to find out what was happening. So he said when he changed direction to draw near and see, God called out to him, inviting him to meet with him from the midst of the rocky heights. And he said, Moshe, Moshe, you know, knowing someone's name makes a difference. He didn't say, hey, you down there, little squirt. He didn't say, hey, shepherd, you nobody. Ha, 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 I'm God. You better run. No, he said, hey, Moshe. Moshe, if God knows his name, wow, pretty impressive. And so he responded, said, look now, here, and see, here I am. Hina ani, behold, notice me, I'm here. That sound like a man that's running away?
No.
No, he said, Moshe, Moshe. And so he responded and said, look now, and see, here I am. Kari is the verb which explains mikra, and in the plural, in the gray, invitations to be called out and meet, being welcomed by God. It is the first word Yahweh spoke to Moshe. Here's the man that scribed the Torah, and the first word that God spoke to him, he said, Kara. Yeah. It was the first word Yahweh spoke, and it would define his mission and their relationship. It describes the path we can walk to follow him home. Moshe was slow of speech, not deaf, so there's a reason that Yahweh repeated his name. My intention, and there was none, so I have to explain how he had come to be here and what he was undertaking. Moshe means to dry out. So dude was well-named. His mission would be to draw the people out of the crucibles of human oppression. Now, henna is usually translated behold. It means to look up, to pay close attention, and take note of the details being presented in the here and now. Moshe used it to draw attention to himself, since henna was followed by ani, me. Yeah, that takes some, you know, listen, Moshe was, Moshe, he had backbone, he had character. He's not the kind of guy that's running. No, he's, he didn't want to go back to Mitzrayim, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, he was right there. Yeah, hey, here I am. God can manifest himself in any form he chooses. Light, which is timeless. Actually, it's timeful, to be more exact, illuminating, and is the purest form of energy. It's his favorite. However, we mortals can only come so close to this much energy without the source of life becoming too intense. Such may have been the case here. I say may because there are different ways to translate the Hebrew letters Aleph, Lamed. They can convey El, God, El, power, El, to or toward, are all, not nothing, or none. So it's either. And he said, do not come near this place. That's one option. Or, he said, or, it was, then God said, approach and draw near this place. So the first rendition, while consistent with most English Bibles, does not work in this context because the last speaker was actually Moshe, and this is clearly God speaking to him. Therefore, El reveals the change of voice from man to God. And the second one, then God said. Moreover, in his last statement, Wa Kara Elhu Elohim, God called out to him, inviting him to meet with him. So the Almighty was summoning Moshe into his presence and welcoming him. Karab not only means to approach and draw near, it is something Yahweh asks of us during the celebration of the Mikra. Additionally, Halom speaks of being in close proximity. Not only would it have been inconsistent with Yahweh's purpose to send Moshe away, since his intent was to spend eternity with him, Moshe would spend 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Horeb upon his return to this place. Right there at the top of the mountain with God. Why would God send him away on this occasion and spend 40 days and 40 nights with him on that occasion, since God is consistent? Yeah, I mean, some of these things are so straightforward and easy. I just don't get it, how people mess this up.
Another bites the dust.
I mean, it's like seeing a condensation trail coming out of an airplane and understanding the combustion process and then saying, nope, I'm not buying that explanation. It's the government trying to poison us 30,000 feet. I mean, gosh, You know, the simplest explanation is often correct. God was there to introduce himself and to meet with Moshe. They were about to become inseparable. And then there's the issue with Na'al, sandals. Why take them off if he was being sent away? How
could
the crowd away from God be special?
Then we got it right, duh.
Even if we were intent on leaving Aleph Lamed as Al rather than El, God, could have been saying that in spite of the evidence to the contrary, you will not be negated and thus reduced to nothing by the intensity of this powerful force by approaching. Now, all things considered, I think this is reasonable. Then God Almighty said, approach and draw near Arab, this place, alone. Take off your sandals from on your feet, because this place, which to show the benefits of the relationship that you are standing upon, it is set apart and special ground. Shema, name, Exodus 3:5. Yahweh wants us to approach him and to be comfortable around him. So God says, hey, slip off your sandals from your feet, for truly, this place is home. Moreover, as upon this rocky mountain without shoes, Moshe wasn't going to run away. God would have his attention for a while. So Mount Horeb, the mountain of God, was chosen because it had not been contaminated by men. It was still special and set apart and could serve as Yahweh's makom, his office, the place where he would provide direction for life. And that instruction would include whom? Being upright in his presence, not bowed down, while ready and willing to whom take a stand against that which is common and corrupt. So while we're no longer broadcasting, we are still recording. We can just go a bit further into Yahweh's word, and it says that everything important to God and essential for us is Kodesh. It's set apart.
Mm-hmm.
If something is ordinary and popular, it's not God. He said, Wa'amar. He continued by communicating, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob. I have always wondered why. God repeatedly says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob. For a couple of reasons. I mean, it's obvious that he's saying this because he formed his covenant with Abraham. Yishak was the first child of the covenant, and Yaakov came to be Israel. So that's pretty straightforward. But you know, Israel had a tendency to be a bit annoying and stubborn. And if you take a moment and think that, you know, Abraham does mean enriching father, even perhaps merciful father. God presents Abraham as the father of a rebellious nature, a nation, a father of a multitude of very contentious people. So that Abraham would have both the symbolic of Yahweh as an enriching and merciful father, but he himself would be the father of a contentious group of people. And I always thought that to mean that, you know, that other nations would claim descendancy from Abraham or legitimacy through Abraham, like Christianity calls itself, as does Islam, an Abrahamic religion, even though Abraham was not the least bit religious and none of them were descendants from him. So you're wondering, so why did God provide that name, this dichotomy of a contentious people And then with Yishak, well, Yishak means I laugh. It is also I mock.
Yeah, you can.
So it has a dark side too. And you know, we talked about mm-hmm. a couple of shows how difficult Yaakov is to translate, because almost everything associated with the name Yaakov is negative. You know, I supplant. I try to put myself in a superior position.
Mm-hmm. Heel catcher.
It was Leah that shared with me about a week ago. She said, you know, the God of Abraham, Yishak, and Yaakov is a pejorative. It's God saying, yeah, I am the God of those contentious people.
Cataracts.
I am the God of those who have mocked me. I am the God who have tried to supplant themselves over me, in addition to being the God of the covenant and the God of Israel. That's something to think about. I'm sure. Sometimes when you hit a stop and say, no, but it certainly explains why those three names are so negative. It also explains why God would say, I'm the God of Abraham, when Abraham, he was a scout. You know, he prostituted his wife, not once, but twice. So, he wasn't the most upstanding boy in the batch. So, Yahweh resolved those issues with him, and they became close over time. But it certainly explains the dichotomy of these people. You know, Yishak and Yaakov did some dumb stuff. So it might just show God's overall reaction to these people. Anyway, to reemphasize on the positive side, he says, I am the God of your father, of the God of Abraham, which is the God of the covenant, the God of Yishak, the God of the first child born into the covenant, the God of Yaakov who became Israel. Yahweh did not say that he was the God of Roman Catholics. He did not say, I am the God of Gentile Christians. He was not the God of the Americas and Americans, the God of the French, the Germans, the English, or the Chinese. He is the God of the covenant with Israel. Yahweh could have stated, Ani Elohim, I am God, and left it at that. But he didn't. It is therefore essential that we recognize this fact and accept the implications. The beneficiaries of the covenant with Abraham, the descendants of Yaakov who became Israel, matter most to Yahweh. They are his people. And that is why he was in this place meeting with Moshe, a Israelite from the tribe of Levi. Now, all of this must have been a bit overwhelming for Moshe. But Moshe concealed his face because he was awestruck from looking at the Almighty. You know, those burning bushes, I mean, that's a lot to take in, huh? No, I don't mm-hmm. think so. Moshe was awestruck because the entire top of that mountain was ablaze, and he had been invited into God's company. And, it was a lot to take in. The entire rocky...
He had seen a lot in Egypt. Yeah.
He had seen a lot.
He'd seen an awful lot of impressive things, so he was pretty impressive.
Yeah. And you know, when trouble came his way, he stood up. He was not a cowardly man. And if the entire rocky height of this barren mountain was ablaze in brilliant light, then it would have been nigh on impossible to stare directly into the face of God's representative. Moreover, Moshe was not afraid, but instead was being respectful. He held God in very high regard. In his office on Mount Horeb, Yahweh got down to business. He laid it on the line. telling Moshe what he already knew. Then Yahweh said, I have witnessed and surely seen the oppression and persecution, the one, the affliction and suffering, the harassment, poverty, misery, and humiliation of my people who are in the crucibles of oppression, Mitzrayim, the cauldrons of religious and governmental, military and economic subjugation, the coercions and cruelty experienced in a place called Egypt, where the people were confined and restricted by religious persecution. Well, if you ever needed affirmation that that definition of Mitzrayim was correct, Yahweh gave it to us with Oni, the oppression and persecution of my people. I have heard their cry of distress because the presence of their oppressive taskmasters who are exploiting them, Nagas. Indeed, I recognize and personally know their pain and suffering. Ben Oni, ever heard of that title before, Kirk?
Yes, sir.
Ben Oni?
Nothing.
Yeah, Ben Oni is son of my affliction, son of my misery, son of my hardship, son of my torment.
Yeah,
it is what, yeah, it's Rachel with,
yeah, Rachel,
called,
yeah,
they, her last son, the son who whose birth killed her. And Jacob named him inappropriately.
Changed it.
Because naming rights for children have always, naming rights have always been for the women. And sometimes
mama,
you ought not change them. Yeah, mama has naming rights. She earns it. She has naming rights. And she named him Benoni, son of my affliction, son of my distress, son of my agony. And so they were experiencing agony, Oni, in Egypt, in the land of Israel.
So it almost, this implies that it's going to take an awful lot to get these people to move off the dam again. And so it's going to happen, just as bad as we think. It's as bad as this explained. So.
Yeah, it took this level of, that's correct. It took this level of misery for Yah's people to finally agree that they would allow God to lead them away from this, to liberate them from this. And, you know, it's going to take that same level of harassment. So that's why it's called the time of Jacob's troubles. If it weren't for the time of Jacob's troubles, I don't think we would see a significant number of Israelites motivated to return to God. And, you know, the last time that Israelites were in dire stress was during the Holocaust. And during the Holocaust, there was no one that was saying, his name is Yahweh. He is calling you home. This is his message. This is his covenant. These are his mikrei. No one. This time there is. So you have the opportunity to respond, to come to know him. And it's going to be a dark period, this time of Jacob's troubles. It's and the word sur is the basis of Mitzrayim. So it is indeed going to be like that again, and if it were not for that, I don't think that we would get a meaningful number of Israelites to respond. Actually, I should say collective we, in the sense that Yahweh likes to work through people, and we are working together with him. It's his responsibility to call them home. It's his message that is calling them home. He is the one that is going to provide for them and protect them and liberate them when they come to his home. It's all Yahweh's doing, but it doesn't change the fact that Yahweh likes to work through and communicate through people. So it isn't appropriate to say we. Our contribution may be de minimis, but since Yahweh wanted to go to Pharaoh with a humble stutterer, So it's just the way that he likes to work. He created humankind to engage in a relationship and to go do stuff together. And he never breaks out of that. Now, even in his return on Yom Kippurim, he's not doing it alone.
No, Dode.
They picked Dode to come back with him, and he's working through Dode. It's just his
even
nature.
In this endeavor. Even in this endeavor, he called his shot on the Knackery long before you wrote a line. So.
Back just shy of 3,000 years.
So you picked up the thing.
He's been planning this for
a long time.
Yeah, he's been planning this for a long time. So it's okay to use we. You know, our part may be infinitesimally small from our perspective and from, but it isn't from God's perspective, because the whole thing, I mean, the entire McGillicuddy, I don't know if that's a Hebrew word. Yes.
Yeah, it is, maybe.
I guess the entire coal. Coal means all, that's all means.
Okay.
Is to work through people. And that's the only reason he created the universe. It's the reason he authored life.
Yeah.
It's the reason that he conceived the garden and brought Adam inside. He enjoys doing stuff with us. He wants to experience what it's like to be a dad. And I want to tell you that, having experienced it, there are moments of wonder and joy, and there are moments where you'd like to pull out all of your hairs. In fact, that seems to be like that would be less painful than parents. That's what he chose. That's what he wants. And so he has to endure the good and bad of being a parent. And as my dearest wife was telling me today, you know, it ain't no honor to be one of those people that Yahweh uses. It's the most fun and wonderful, fulfilling thing in the world. But he is not about choosing the best and brightest.
Nor are you.
Yeah, so
sometimes, yes, but not all the time.
No argument on that point. But so that's a good thing. It's it means that you can't brag.
No.
You can state the facts, and you ought to state the facts, and you ought to state exactly the way that Yahweh says it, and run from it. And you know, Moshe
was in an
exceedingly important role, but. It was Yahweh's doing. It wasn't Moshe's doing. It's just that Yahweh chose to work with this man. And sometimes, you know, Yahweh chooses to work with somebody because they're a rascal, and he loves working with rascals. The lovable rogue is somebody that seems to be highly appealing to him. He likes to work with people with a backbone, so someone will say, no, get out of here. I don't want you in our company. You're a hot mess. You're just screwing everything up. Just go away. He likes people like that. He does. And he likes people that are going to go where the words lead. And if it isn't popular, they don't care.
No.
It's what God said, and that's the way it is. And if you don't like it, tough. And when, you know, the thought police ban you.
You're 100% free to reject it.
That is correct. And the thought police are not smart enough to actually listen and think that they are wise and productive to inflict on people a deprivation of freedom, taking us to the conditions that exist in communist Russia and now exist in communist China, as if that is a step forward. Well, I'm sorry for you. I can't fix you. I can't solve your problem. I think it's disgusting. But nonetheless, I'm not here to fix you. And I'm certainly not going to beg with you or plead with you. So, I work for somebody that will get his job done regardless of your interference or your stupidity. So it's not a big worry. But it's true that God likes to work with these interesting characters. I mean, every one of them had some form of flaw. And I guess if since God's perfect, it would be really boring if he tried to develop a relationship with someone else who's perfect. It's like a child. If your child was born fully functioning and able to outperform you in every field, and
you
couldn't
teach
them anything, they already knew it all, what would parenting be? What's the purpose? So God is wants us to have needs to be to benefit from learning, to so that he can contribute. Because when you contribute to a child's growth and to their ability to be more than they would be otherwise, it's the most rewarding thing in the universe. And so for that to occur, the parent has to be wiser than the child. And that is Yahweh's relationship with us, which is why he tells us to trust and rely upon him. It's why his hand is reaching out down to us to lift us up. Marvelous story. Well, we're going to pick up the story of Moshe this time next week. And we hope the thought police don't act up and be badly again. But, you know, if they do, that's their own little world.
Well,
we have lots of websites. Stephen posted the last week's show. I guess there's a replacement now for YouTube and Facebook. It's called We. I am your. Anytime you want to know something about social media, you just come to me. I am your foremost expert.
You're right on top of that, aren't you?
I'm really right on top of that. So it's MeWe. MeWe is where he's posted. I guess it's the first up and coming replacement for the Thought Police for Facebook and the like. So that is encouraging that there is a place that we can go. And of course, it's at the Yahweh Bereth website, your website, JB. It's in websites that Richard originally established that are continuing to be run. What's the name of that other website?
Bless Yahweh. Yeah,
pardon? Bless Yahweh. Yes, Bless Yahweh. Yeah, blessyahweh.com is another one of the sites that all the books and the programs and the shows are presented. And before long, we're going to get the Yada Yahweh website back up in its entirety. And may even get Yoel to make a curtain call from time to time.
Wow.
Yes, sir?
I like Yoel. No, I like Yoel.
Kirk?
No, I just said I like Yoel. He's cool.
Yes, yeah, we'll get Yoel back. We had a long talk about a week or so ago of him reengaging.
Great.
I think we'll have that happen as well. Well, may Yah bless. We look forward to being with you next week. We'll continue this story that evolves through the Mikra. And I hope we can catch up to where I am on the translations, because I've gone back through Yahweh's instructions to Moshe and the children of Yisrael as they were living in, were about ready to flee Mitzrayim. Some of the insights, and I'm having so much fun with, because some of the words that he chose and what they mean are so descriptive of Yahweh's intent. I'm just delighted we've gone back to retranslate this and I've been inspired to rewrite the commentary, because there's so much that is interesting that I had missed for so long. And so it's a real treasure. I think we'll enjoy this whole ride as we work our way up through the Mikra and beyond. So may Yahweh blessed have a wonderful Shabbat to one and all. We'll be with you again this time next week. Good night.
Okay. Shabbat shalom, y'all. Come on.